Have you ever noticed how excited everyone is when a baby is born? Everyone, you know, the parents are thrilled. They look at that little mewing infant and say, oh, what is it going to be? How is life going to be for this child? You know, how they envision the next year, they dream and of the new experiences, the new world the baby will face that they didn't face. And then they take the baby home from the hospital and reality sets in. What sounded like a really good thing 9 months earlier, what seemed like it would be just so wonderful when the baby was born, now is the reality of being awake half the night with a crying infant, changing smelly diapers, a new interrupted lifestyle where you can't leave home anytime you want. You can't even just run out for a hamburger. You've got a baby. And, of course, we all know that's one of the challenges, but it's also a new and exciting time, and good things will come, even through the challenges, through the difficulty that they go through. 13 years ago, when we banded together as a church to proclaim God's grace here in central Wyoming, from our unique perspective, we had no clue what the baby would turn out to be. I'm looking around and I still have no clue what the baby is going to be, how it's going to all work. But we're faithful week by week with whoever God brings in that particular week. Someone said, well, some of your folks can only come once every 3 or 4 months or every third week or whatever. Well, okay, fine. If you're here, we proclaim the word. If you're not here, it's online, so you can look at it there. But we're excited to see how this developed. The Jewish nation had been developing ever since Abram's day, and here they've been camped out for almost a full year, just a couple weeks short of a full year at Mount Sinai, and now it was time to move ahead. A new year, so to speak, had come, and they needed the faith to take that first step. So today we're going to talk about a change, because the focus of the book of Exodus has been on one word, the Exodus. You go, well, duh. Yeah, but that's the focus. It's been on get out of Egypt and get to Mount Sinai. And as we've looked through 38 messages from that beginning of Exodus chapter 1 until we finish the tabernacle and Exodus as it concluded, this has been the focus. But now it's changing. What had been a casual mention that they would leave Egypt and go to a promised land, mentioned just a couple of times, now becomes the new focus. We're leaving Sinai, we're leaving the Mount of God, and we're heading to the promised land. And so I like to think of this as a promised land type message. And the idea here that we are a promised land people looking ahead to heaven. The Jews were looking ahead to going out from the mountain to the new land. So let's just take a moment and review, because Genesis talks about God forming and calling Israel from Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. Exodus, delivering Israel. Leviticus, as God sanctified it. And we talked just briefly in Leviticus about the different offerings that were there. Then Numbers is where he's disciplining, he's training, he's teaching, he's working with Israel to grow up, to leave the infancy stage, to leave the toddler stage, and get out and follow God and do right. And then Deuteronomy about his love for Israel as he leads them then into Joshua, the promised land. Exodus covered a year, a little bit more. Leviticus about 1 month. Numbers chapters 1 to 10 that we're going to look at today in kind of an overview sermon encompasses a couple of weeks And the rest of numbers encompasses 38 and a half years. So there's things in there we don't want to leave out. I know when we started preaching, we said we're going to preach through Exodus. And you say, okay, you did that. You finished last week. Start something new. Not quite yet. We've got some lessons here that we need to teach the toddlers. We need to teach the young people and the book of Numbers, because there are principles here that impact our life and events that happen to Israel. You might have heard some stories as a child about the fiery serpents that came, or about Moses striking the rock a second time and not getting into the promised land, of Balaam and his talking donkey, whom I think he named Mr. Ed, but I'm not sure the donkey's name there. But there are some stories we want to not neglect. So we're going to just take a few extra weeks here in January, February, and kind of try and tie a bow, as it were, around the Exodus here. Because this is important. It's important for us to understand the chronology of it. That, you know, on day one of the Exodus was the Passover. They had the Passover, and then that night the order was given by Pharaoh to get out, leave. And before it was daybreak, they were gathered together and ready to head on out of Egypt. They were by Sukkoth in day 9. They crossed the Red Sea. They were in Rephidim in the wilderness, where the water came from a rock, in day 42. Day 44, they arrive in the wilderness around Sinai, and we all know day 53 through 99 is the Ten Commandments and Moses spending 40 days. Then the golden calf, and Moses spending 40 more days up on the mountain. And then all the way to day 365, when the Passover is celebrated in the second year, the second time, the Passover there. And then a few days later, the cloud is lifted from the tabernacle, and they head out on their journey. The book of Numbers, where our focus is turned to now, is called Numbers because it starts out numbering the people. But that's really not the best name for the book. The Hebrew name for each of the books in the Old Testament is simply the first word of each book. Now, the first word in English doesn't correspond to the first word or phrase in Hebrew. But in Numbers chapter 1, verse 1, the phrase is used, and it begins the Hebrew Bible with the word wilderness, literally in the wilderness. It's a locative noun that talks about where they are in the wilderness. And so better than Numbers, the Jewish Bible, the Tanakh, would simply say wilderness, because that's where they're going to be through the entire book of Numbers. Now, if I were giving the name to the book of Numbers, I would call it Lost, because that's what it seems like they were the whole time. They were just sort of lost out in the wilderness somewhere. But the reality is that the wilderness is never the destination of God's people. God's intention was to take them from Egypt, give them the law, teach them, train them about worship and discipline and the rules to live by, and then take them to the promised land, about 10 days walk from Sinai to the southernmost reaches of the promised land. The wilderness was a temporary place. And now remember, the word wilderness doesn't mean the Sahara Desert. It doesn't mean Hell's Half Acre. It means, what would be the Indian word for wilderness? Shoshone, I think. Or wait, that's a city that we... But you know what I'm talking about. In Wyoming, we have areas that don't get enough rain to really make growing anything possible. But it's got grass, it's got some trees, it's got some scrub. It's got an area where it literally, the Hebrew word midbar means the grazing land. Okay, that describes Wyoming pretty good. The early travelers didn't stay in Wyoming. The earliest people coming by stopped here for a bit, trapped some animals. Then the Oregon Trail era of the 1840s and 50s came. And what did people do? They got in wagons. They hit Wyoming down by Fort Laramie. They left Wyoming down by Fort Bridger because they wanted to get across Wyoming to go someplace nice. They were farmers. They took one look at Wyoming and said, this is not farmland. This is good for antelope and buffalo and cattle. And of course, it still is that way today unless you have some irrigation ditches because of our arid rainfall. So the Jews are in this wilderness, marginal land, good for their sheep and their goats, a little bit okay for the cattle that they had, but it was pretty tough. But God was trying to give them his plan, his big vision, that I am leading you. All you have to do is trust and obey. I've heard that somewhere, right? For there's no other way. Well, the Jews found another way, but there's no other way to be happy in Jesus than to trust and obey. Israel had emerged from Egypt as a slave people, unsuited for the promised land. They had been told, this is what you have to do. And if you do this, we'll give you food and you can live another day. That's what they were getting in Egypt. So they were looking for somebody to tell them what to do and give them what they needed, and that was good enough. God needed to transform a slave-minded people into a promised land people. A people that would not sit back and be slaves. Just say, well, just feed me, give me something. If I'm hungry, you know, I'll whine if I don't get food or whatever. Or a people that said, oh, we can be free. That means we can do whatever we want. God needed to change them. And at Mount Sinai, with the law and with all the things that were done, the building of the tabernacle, the sacrifices that were made, he taught them how to submit to him, how to grow up, how to be a promised land people. And that's what we need to be. Every day that we walk in this life, we need to be thinking about the promised land, about heaven. Not about, what can I get here? Do I have enough food? How can I handle all this? Jesus himself said in Matthew 6, you know, take no thought about tomorrow. Take no thought about your clothing, your food. God takes care of the birds, doesn't he? You're more important than birds, aren't you? I mean, some of you are looking at others wondering, but that's a rhetorical question. Yes, we're more important than birds, more important than the flowers. God says, I want to train you, I want to teach you. And then, after we've learned the lessons at Mount Sinai, God says, okay, time to go, and we're going to put you to a test, because, of course, that's how God works. When he teaches us lessons, we're tested to see whether we understood, whether we pass or fail. If we fail, what happens?
Get the same lesson over.
Yeah, we get to repeat the lesson till we pass it. And then when we pass the lesson, what happens? We get new lessons, usually harder lessons, right? Isn't that how it starts? You know, don't you remember math class? Where they started out recognizing numbers. I was good at that. I could count by fives, tens. I could do 1 to 100. I could do 100 backwards. It was fabulous. Then the evil teachers said, yeah, but now that you're out of kindergarten, you have to be able to add these numbers. And so I spent a whole year in school learning how to add. And then I finally mastered that, came back to school in the fall of the second grade, and the teacher said, okay, now we're going to teach subtraction. And you're going to have to learn how to borrow. I've been borrowing ever since, but that's another story. You're going to have to learn all the stuff about subtraction. And I thought, why? I know numbers. I can add them up. Why do I need to worry about anything more? New lesson. When I learned subtraction in second grade, then I went to third grade. And by the way, my kindergarten teacher came and taught the third grade class because she loved us so much. And she came back and said, okay, now we're going to teach multiplication. Now that you can add and subtract, because you can't multiply until you can add and subtract. Some of us can't multiply, even if we can add and subtract. But the idea was there. And then fourth grade, division. Fifth grade, fractions. Sixth grade, the dismal system. Or that's what I call it all the time. You know, decimals and percentages and things like that. And then shapes and objects and area and circumference and pi are round. That was, I kept trying to convince the teacher, pi are round, not pi are square. You know, dumb teachers, I don't understand. But see, that's what we're doing. We learn progressively. And then it got worse because the evil teachers began to substitute letters for numbers and said, X equals 3Y. Find X. And I went, I don't understand this. Why do you want me to find your X? You know, and why? I was not a fun student to have in a class, you can imagine. That's what God does. We laugh about that because we can all relate to that. But folks, that's what God is doing right now. He's sending us lessons and then saying we need to pass it. Okay. How did he prepare? The first 10 chapters of Numbers. You say we're going to cover 10 chapters in Numbers? Yes, but we're going to cover chapters 1 to 9 very quickly to get kind of an overview here of the preparation for the Promised Land people. And then chapter 10, we're going to spend the last bit of our sermon time on as they actually say, hey, it's time to go. It's time to leave. So let's look at the Promised Land preparation. If you turn your Bibles to Numbers chapter 1, we're going to just look at a verse or so from each of these chapters and kind of give you the simple message of what was given here. Because 150 times, did you hear that? 150 times in the book of Numbers, it says, the Lord spoke to Moses. The Lord spoke to Aaron. The Lord spoke to his people. 150 times. This is God's lessons that are coming out. And so we need to pay attention because this is good. So in Wilderness chapter 1, or Numbers in your Bible, Wilderness chapter 1, we see the census of the soldiers. God said in verse 2, take a census of all the congregation of the people of Israel by clans, by their fathers' houses, according to the number of names, every male, head by head. This is a military census. Military age men who are 20 to 50, who can fight. This was an inventory to say, this is how many soldiers we have from these families of the clan of Judah. And then these families from the clan of Asher or Naphtali. And they go down in order in chapter 1 because you see, getting to Mount Sinai was the easy part. Crossing the Red Sea, leaving Egypt, fighting the Amalekites, getting to the law and listening and doing what God said and building the tabernacle and learning to sacrifice, that was the easy part. When they reached the Promised Land, they were going to have to fight. Now, was God going to be with them? Was God going to help them? Was God going to do miracles? You're thinking, oh yeah, there's that next book. It's called Joshua and Jericho, and we remember that. You know, God's going to be there, but at the same time, it's a battle. And the focus here has to be that even though God's hand is going to be on them, they need to take an honest inventory of their strength, of their weakness. You know, we're going to send out a part of our soldiers out here to do a battle, and they're going to come from the tribe of Judah. Well, that's great, because Judah's got 70,000 fighting men. But Levi has 20,000. So we need to know. We need to understand that. And so Numbers 1 is the census that was taken to, so that they would know their strengths and weaknesses. And of course, the lessons we get from that are very simple. That we need to take a census and say, what are my strengths, weaknesses? What can I do? What gifts do I have? What natural abilities or talents do I have? How is God working? In 1963, in 10th grade, we had a government class, and part of the thing that we had to learn in that was what we wanted to be, and as our teacher would always say, if you grow up. But the idea of when we grow up, what do you want to be? And we had a whole format of things and say, what talents do you have? How are you gifted? What do you like to speak publicly? How many of you enjoy speaking publicly? You say, I just enjoy that. Okay, Levi, both hands up. Oh, no, he's just stretching. Okay. Most people don't do that. I loved it. Do you enjoy teaching? Sharing your knowledge with others, making sure that they learn it, giving them tests, making them squirm. I don't remember all the options on the scenario, but I thought, God, that's what I want to be. God had a little different plan in the whole thing. But we need to do that. And say, I have strength. You might have different strengths than I have. You might be able to be nice to people. I have real trouble with that. You might not say so much rather than say too much, which I have real trouble with. And so each of us has to do that. Numbers chapter 2, verse 2, the people of Israel shall camp each by his own standard with the banner over their father's house. They shall camp facing the tent of meeting on every side. So it was real simple. Here's the tabernacle. It faces east. We're going to have three tribes on each side. Of course, the Levites are going to be all around the tabernacle because they're the ones working there every day. But then the whole encampment of the largest and the two smallest tribes will be off to the east. And then you can go through Numbers chapter 2 and see that God is a God of order and organization. There are principles here that God was moving. He was preparing. He was planning. And on each side of the tabernacle, they put up a giant standard. They put up a big giant flag. On the flag of Judah, there was a lion. On the flag on Reuben's side of the tabernacle, for all the three tribes there, there was a man's head that was on the standard. On Ephraim's side, there was an ox. On Dan's side, there was an eagle. So all the tribes that were gathered, they had a standard. They had a big flag that they could salute. Well, and I thought, Moses, where'd you ever come up with those ideas of a lion and a man and an ox and an eagle? Well, where had Moses been? He'd been up on the mountain, had seen visions of heaven in the heavenly tabernacle. And God had given him detailed, so many cubits and so long and short and everything to build the tabernacle. Well, what's in heaven? In Revelation chapter 4, verse 7, flying around the throne of God were four living creatures. The first one was like a lion, the second like a calf, the third like a face of a man, and the fourth like an eagle. Hello? Moses was just making a banner for the people that they could carry, and they would know then that as they marched, the three tribes around Judah would follow the banner that had a lion on it. The three tribes that traveled with Dan would have an eagle, and so forth. And so, a beautiful picture here that God is a God of order. And that when we want to do things our way instead of God's way, we fail the test. We're going to have to learn all over again. God wants us to follow what his word says. God says, I've given you a pattern. You got to learn it. Back to third grade. What did we learn in third grade math? Multiplication. Okay. I was old school. I don't know how many of you were raised that way, but I was old school where you memorize the multiplication tables. And I do that to the great distraction and dismay of my grandchildren. when we're traveling, when we're doing anything together, I ask him questions. Okay, I said, I don't want you to even think a second. I just want you to give me the answer. Okay? What's 6 times 6?
36.
What's 9 times 9?
81.
See, you guys know these things. Why? Because you just memorized them. Rote, nasty, memorize that whole thing. I got the zeros real quick. 0 times 1, 0 times 2, 0 times... I was good at that, but it got a little tougher from there on. But the idea is that this is the way God is. He gives us lessons, and then he tests. In his organization, he said, let's set up the camp. We got the number of people now. Let's set up the camp in this structure. Numbers chapter 3, they did a census of the Levites, and we're not going to go into all those verses at all, but there's basically 22,000 of military age, but none of them are going to have to fight because they're busy with the tabernacle and all the work of the Lord. The others can fight. By the way, how did they keep coming up with 12 tribes if the tribe of Levi is never included?
Two from Joseph.
Oh, you got it. The tribe of Joseph is divided into his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And so it ends up with 12 tribes plus Levi. Numbers chapter 4 deals with the duty of the Levites. Way down in verse 49, according to the commandments through Moses, they were listed, each one with his task of serving or carrying. They were listed by him as the Lord commanded Moses. The Levites were numbered. Chapter 3, chapter 4, they're saying, okay, these guys are going to carry wood. They're in full-time ministry. They don't have to work. They don't have to do anything else, but they're going to go out, find wood in the wilderness, saw down trees, whatever you have to do, and bring it in there because they're going to offer sacrifices. You need to have wood for the fire. Each one had a role to play. Some would take down cords and tent walls, and others, you know, seemed like glamorous. They would be able to go to the Ark of the Covenant wrapped in the beautiful linen veil that had covered the side walls and the top of the tabernacle, now wrapped around it. And had poles, and they, you know, boy, I bet the older veteran priests could do that. The Levites, they got the honor of carrying that. And by the way, when they hit 50 and had to retire, what? Retire at age 50? They could no longer carry wood or carry the items. They were set aside, you can read it, as guards. They were set aside to watch the tabernacle, make sure nobody tried to sneak in under the tent or whatever it might be there. That was their role. Each had a role. God made them dependent on each other, and the whole nation in their worship dependent on these men. They were all consecrated. They were all priests. They were all, but they weren't all doing the same work. Because God is not the God that says, I want everything to be uniform. Even in the church, God gives different roles. You know, we have different people who take care of the books of the church, and different people to take care of the communion, different people to hand out bulletins, different people to do different roles in the church. Different jobs meeting diverse needs, but all with the same DNA. We all have the same code inside. So there's no division, no jealousy, whatever. Numbers chapter 5. Didn't I tell you we're going to go through this quickly? Numbers chapter 5. The purity of the people. Look at verse 2. He said, command the children of Israel to put out of the camp every leper. He's dealing with physical health issues here. Saying if you've got a discharge, if you've got leprosy, leprosy, by the way, is a skin disease, and nobody knew whether it was permanent, infectious, or whether it was just a minor issue that would soon pass. But disease and death, put out of the camp. If you touch the dead body, you just put outside the camp for 7 days, then you give a little offering and you come back in. It was a picture to the people to keep them pure, to keep them untainted from disease or death as they march to the promised land. He goes on to moral health, beginning in verse 5 of Numbers 5. It says, if a man or a woman commits any sin that people commit in unfaithfulness against the Lord, and that person is guilty, he should confess his sin. And it goes on to, in great detail there of how they should offer a sacrifice and make restitution. Because remember, restitution is not just to give money to someone you offended. Restitution means more to me than to them. Restitution is something that happens, and that works on the person who gives the gift, who says, yeah, I'm guilty. I'm the one that's a problem here, and admit their sin. And so their physical health, the moral health, and the mental health. The chapter ends by talking to people who are suspicious. Oh, if their wife was, she might have been unfaithful. Oh, my husband might not be serving the Lord. And, you know, what to do and all that. And again, it's a lot of details. It meant something to the Jews, but the principle is there, yet for us, that if you want to be pure, it's not just outward purity, but it's an inward purity. It's in our moral, in our thinking. Because promised land people interact with other promised land people. And we're different from the slaves of Egypt, the slaves to sin that we were before. Numbers chapter 6, talking about vows and blessings here. It begins in the chapter 6 with the Nazirite vow. People who wanted to have a special close walk with God, separate themselves from the comforts and pleasures of the world, they could take a special vow. They wouldn't cut their hair, they'd eat certain things, they would. The great many things, if you think of John the Baptist, he would have taken a Nazirite vow. Now, don't get confused. Nazareth the Nazirite. Jesus was not a Nazirite. Jesus was a Nazarene from Nazareth. And so it's the same root word, but it's a totally different meaning here that they had. This is a special group. But I want us to focus in number 6 down in verse 23 and following, if you would. Do you have it there? Turn the page. Number 6, 23. Speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, thus you shall bless the people of Israel. You'll say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. Have you heard that prayer before? I think I did that at more than 1,000 weddings, and I said that same prayer as a prayer of blessing on the couple. And that, you know, I'm not big on written prayers. When our Republicans had our convention here for the county and all that, they called on me to lead in prayer, and yes, I wrote out a bunch of phrases. I know you're saying, oh, Pastor, how could you do that? It's a little nervousness there. I just want to make sure I say the right thing and don't call down God's damnation instead of God's blessing or something like that on the people there. But Spurgeon said, free prayer is most useful, but in a benediction, it's well to be dictated, as God here put his very words in the mouth of the priest. God wants to bless us. We want to be happy. We want to be comfortable. We want to pass algebra, if I can bring up a math illustration again. We have all sorts of goals. God says, I want to bless you. Shouldn't that be our priority? That God blesses us more than anything else? I love that. 6 times, did you read that in these verses? 6 times, God bless you. God keep you. God is pleased with you. God shows his grace, his tender mercies to you. God continues to look or pay attention to you and your need. And God gives peace to you. 6 times, folks. This is personal. This is for us. And I love how it's worded here. I think we might be on safe enough ground that I can say that, that this even pictures a little bit of the Trinity. Because notice how it says in these verses, God, the Father, bless and keep you. God, the Son, is pleased to give you grace. God, the Spirit, knows our needs and gives us peace. It just says the Lord. It just says God do this. But I think maybe we can at least interpolate a little bit out of there the Godhead working for our benefit. Numbers chapter 7, interesting chapter that is one of the most repetitious in the book of Numbers. Because it talks about gifts for the tabernacle and what each tribe was to do, and the leaders of each of the 12 tribes were to come, and over 12 days they all gave offerings. Now you have some big tribes, some little tribes, some rich tribes, some poor tribes, and what did they do? Over 12 days the leaders of each of the 12 tribes came before the Lord and recorded, they gave the identical gift. There was none better, none worse, none richer or poorer, none in sickness or in health or something like that. I don't know how it all works. But the idea here is that they all work together to give, to humbly. Because you see, a slave wants to get. Where am I going to get my next meal? What am I going to get? Can I rest now? That's what a slave wants. A promised land people, a free person, wants to give. God's given me everything. What can I give to Him? How can I give back? How can I show my love? I show my love to my wife and my family by giving them things. That's just a natural human thing to do. I don't say to my kids, okay, now I raise you. You're in my home for 22 years till you got married. Now it's your turn. Start paying me back. We'll go with maybe 10 grand a year for the next 22 years. It sounds good, but if you knew my children, you'd know that I'd be broke. I wouldn't be getting it. That's not what we do. I didn't give them all those wonderful things because I expected that they would give them back. No, I gave them because I love them. That's what they did in the gifts of the tabernacle. And we're told, even additionally in Numbers 7, that Moses went into the tabernacle and heard the voice of the Lord. He heard the voice speaking to him that was above the mercy seat. He couldn't go in there. He couldn't go into the mercy seat. That was only the high priest once a year. But on the other side of the veil, as he prayed, he heard the voice of the Lord. We need promised land people who will be giving. And we need promised land people who will listen to the voice of God. When God says, this is what you need to do. Numbers 8, the workers are cleansed. You can read the chapter on purification, guidelines for the age and service of the workers there. And then Numbers chapter 9, the Passover, beginning in Numbers 9, verse 3. See, this is just preparation. They haven't left yet. They're still, this is all just in the few days there at Mount Sinai from the end of Exodus. He says, on the 14th day of the month at twilight, verse 3, chapter 9, verse 3, you shall keep the Passover at its appointed time. According to all the statutes and all its rules, you'll keep it. Some were concerned they weren't going to be there. God said, do it when you get back. Some said, I'm unclean. I've had an issue here, and for 7 days I'm unclean. I can't observe the Passover. God said, do it next month on the 14th. Do it. Follow the rule. But God wasn't so strict that he was going to strike them dead if he was following one law and having to not follow another. He was working and accommodating here to the people that they observe the ordinance and that they remember, just as we remember each week as we meet together, the Lord's death till he comes. Down in verse 15, Moses is now later on writing, saying in Numbers 9:15, on the day that the tabernacle was set up, the cloud covered the tabernacle, the tent of testimony. At evening it was over the tabernacle like the appearance of fire until morning. So it was always. The cloud covered it by day, the appearance of fire by night. And whenever the cloud lifted from the tent, after that the people of Israel set out to the place where the cloud stopped, where it settled down. And that's where the people camped. God gave them the tabernacle and gave them his leading and simply said, just obey me. Follow the rules, follow the Passover, do what you say, and then remember, when the cloud gets up and moves, you follow the Lord. I like the idea of the cloud in the midst of the camp. It's kind of like a giant nightlight, wouldn't you say? A cloud of fire in the middle of the camp. You can be miles away, and you can see that. I live, 5 miles from the little flame out here at the refinery down the hill from us right now. But at night, if I get up high enough, I can look out there and I can see that flame burning. Now that flame is not that big. We're talking about a pillar of fire that went up into the air and lit up the night. No enemy would dare approach the camp. There'd be no need to fear with God's night light on. In the day, this pillar of cloud would go up, and I'm thinking, boy, that'd be great. That would be shade. If you're out in the wilderness walking, don't you need a little bit of shade once in a while? I kind of maneuver around so that I'd be under the shade of that big pillar of cloud that was there. Isaiah said in Isaiah 25, you're a strength to the poor, a strength to the needy in distress, a refuge from the storm, and a shade from the heat. I don't know if Isaiah was just thinking back to the stories of the wilderness wandering. The psalmist said in Psalm 121, the Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade on your right hand. And so we need to recognize and have that. The Lord as our light, as our shade, the blessed controller of all things. Brings us to chapter 10. Final point, just bear with me. Chapter 10, they're going to leave at the end of chapter 10. So we're going to get there. Chapter 10, verses 1 to 3. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, make 2 silver trumpets. Of hammered work you should make them, and you'll use them to summon the congregation for breaking of camp. When both are blown, all the congregation will gather themselves at the entrance of the tent of meeting. This is it. The final details. We're going to leave. You got to have trumpets to call and let the people know it's time to go. I love it. The way to celebrate God's leading, God's people. We come together. The leaders of all the tribes gather at the front door of the tabernacle and stand there. Okay, we heard the trumpets. We're here. Let's go. And I know this might seem like a corny application, but I am looking forward to the trumpet blowing. I'm looking forward to the Lord returning with a shout, the voice of the archangel, and the trump of God. And when the trumpet sounds, I'm thinking, that's summoning me to the front door of the tabernacle. And Paul says in 1 Thessalonians 4:16, that the Lord then, with the sound of the trumpet, the dead in Christ will rise first. We who are alive, who are left, will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and thus shall we ever be with the Lord. Boy, the Jews have nothing on us, folks. Those Israelis, they hear the trumpet. Oh, time to go to the tabernacle. One day we're going to hear the trumpet. And we're going to gather in glory. And somebody says, oh, I want to go to glory. I want to go to glory because I have loved ones there. I have loved ones in heaven and I want to see them. And I do. But I know who I'm going to see first. I know where I'm going first. I'll talk to Mom. I'll talk to Dad. I'll talk to the relatives that went on before. But I'm looking forward to meeting Jesus. The departure is there. The preparation is over. Numbers chapter 10, verse 11. In the second year, in the second month, on the 20th day of the month, that's a month and 6 days after the Passover, after the yearly anniversary, the cloud lifted from over the tabernacle of testimony, and the people of Israel set out by stages from the wilderness of Sinai. They set out for the first time at the command of the Lord by Moses. Previously, it had all been from Egypt. Now, it's to the promised land. Not from, but to the promised land. They were ordered, they were organized, they were cleansed, they were purified, they were set apart, they were blessed, they were taught how to give and function as a nation of priests. They recalled the judgment, they knew deliverance was at hand, and they were going to follow God's presence as a guide. That's, folks, that's what they did. They learned the lessons. That's from Exodus 1 all the way here to Numbers 10, 13. They knew it. They were ready to actually go to the promised land. And they figured, this is a piece of cake. This is going to be easy breezy. This is going to be a nice journey. We're going to leave here. They talked to probably visitors and caravans that had come through the wilderness area where they'd been camped. And they heard, okay, it's about 10 days up to the edge of the promised land. Another 10 days up to the key, first of the key cities of the promised land. And we'll be there within the month. We'll be there. Because we finished basic training and we're ready to go. I don't know how many of you were in the military, but basic training wasn't the end. It was just the beginning. Boot camp finishes some things of the preparation, but it's just beginning the actual battle. You know, I'm a Civil War reenactor, and I get to read a lot of diaries and stories of the soldiers of old. And they all said that they went and they marched until their feet were bloody from marching, and they drilled and they learned the bayonet maneuvers and they learned how to load their rifles, and they went on and on and on. They said, they're bored to death, just let us go out there and fight. Then when they got to fight and actually see the enemy and take a shot at him, and worse, watch the shots coming at them from the enemy, that was called seeing the elephant. Okay, remember the idea of the circuses and the, all of that idea? You know, elephants were only in zoos and just very rarely seen. But once you saw it, you never forgot what an elephant looked like. And they saw the elephant. And after that, you read their diaries, and all, they were very happy to stay in camp. They were very happy to march and drill and garrison a building or a fort somewhere. None of them wanted to go back and fight again because they knew how difficult it would be. The preparation is over, but it was exactly that, preparation. An interesting little story is found in verse 29 of this chapter as we wind down to the last verses. Numbers chapter 10, verse 29. Okay, it's ready to go. Moses said to Hobab, the son of Reuel. Reuel is another name for Jethro, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law. So this is Moses' brother-in-law, Hobab. He said, we're setting out from the place to which the Lord said, I will give it to you. Come with us. We'll do good to you, for the Lord has promised good to us. Hobab said, I won't go. I won't leave my own land or my own kindred. Moses said, please don't leave us. You know where we should camp. You know the way back. You know, remember, these guys are shepherds. He said, if you go with us, whatever good the Lord will do for us, the same he'll do for you. Don't stay here in the wilderness. Go back to Midian. Come with us. It's going to be great. The offer was rejected. He informed him. It reminded me of so many of my friends and acquaintances that I've shared the gospel with. And I told them about the power of God saving me, cleansing me from the guilt of sin, and freeing me, and how wonderful it's going to be, and how great heaven is going to be. And I've had friends say, I don't want to go there. I don't want to go to heaven. I'd rather go to hell and be with all my friends. I don't want to go to heaven if I have to sit on a cloud and play a harp and sing to Jesus. I don't even do that now. Why would I want to do it then? And I tried to explain it. I'm like Moses. I inform them and appeal to them about how great it's going to be. I invite them and say personally, hey, we've been friends. Moses had been friends with Hobab for 40 years. He was his brother-in-law. He wasn't just being a travel agent saying, hey, buy a ticket here and I'll make a profit off of it. No, he'd say, just join us. Just come with us and be part of it. Join the whole group. He talked about the involvement, how others would help him and they would all be blessed together. And the incentive is God's doing great things with us. He can do great things with you. Moses didn't take no as an answer. But Hobab didn't want to go. What happened to Hobab, by the way? I always, when I was reading this story to my children, I always call him, hey, Bob. I kind of reversed the vowels in the sentence. What did Hobab do? Well, we're not told much. But if you go all the way over to Judges chapter 1, verse 6, it says the descendants. Now, okay, Joshua is over 7 years. Okay, 40 years wandering. 7 years conquering the land. Now Judges begin. Judges chapter 1. And it says, verse 16, the descendants of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, okay, his line, went up with the people of Judah from the city of Palms, which is Jericho, into the wilderness of Judah that lies in the Negev near Arad. And they went and they settled with the people of God. I am so pleased. Moses gave this invitation. It looks like, no, I'm going back to my family. I'm going back to the kins, folk back home. But 47 years later, this little postscript stuck in Judges would say, oh yeah, the descendants, the family there, those Midianites, the Kenites from that tribe. Midian, remember, was one of the sons of Abraham through Keturah, his second wife, after Sarah had died. And so, good people, but they weren't going to go. Well, they ended up, oh yeah, they were there with Joshua and Jericho. They were there in the conquest to go into the land of Judah, and they were settled there. What a blessing. His family, don't know if he did or not, but his family reached the promised land. They shared in the victory and made the correct choice. So, it's time to leave. It's time to go. And Moses said, I'm going to pray for you. Isn't that what you do when somebody's leaving? You pray. I always get a little bit of a smile out of my grandkids because when they leave the house, I always, you know, we promise to give my kids money when they leave to buy gas. I said, you won't get it coming, but if you want to leave, I'll give you money. There's a mentality there, you have to understand me. And so we give them some money that'll cover their gas both ways, by the way. But then we say, let's just gather together, pray. And we make a bologna sandwich, you know how that is, you know, where you gather everybody together and somebody's in the middle. And you squeeze them and I say, okay, we're going to pray together. And I always pray seriously that the Lord bless them and watch over them and keep them and lift their face upon them. The Aaronic blessing that we just looked at a few minutes ago. But then I say, and Lord, help them watch out for the crazy drivers that are out there on the road. Help them watch out for animals so they don't hit one and kill some poor innocent Bambi. And the kid, you know, I can feel them as I'm hugging them. They're kind of going, oh, Grandpa. And then, but I'm serious. I want to bless them. Verse 33 of Numbers 10. So they set out from the mount of the Lord, 3 days' journey. The Ark of the Covenant of the Lord went before them that 3 days' journey to seek out the next camping place for them. And the cloud of the Lord was over them by day whenever they set out from camp. It's not enough to believe. It's not enough to say, oh yeah, I've learned all the lessons. It's not enough to say, yep, I came, the trumpets blew. Not enough to know good theology. Not enough to memorize 1 Peter. It's not enough to be able to do whatever is available out there to do. God said, no, I want you to face the reality. When I say go, you go. The Jewish rabbis taught that the Jews went for 3 days, and there's no mention of any camping place whatsoever. They marched for 3 days and three nights. The rabbi said that's because they wanted to get away from the law as fast as they could. They wanted to forget everything that they heard at Sinai and just run out, go some other direction. Sort of like you all here in about 2 minutes when we close the sermon. Yeah, okay, time to put on our coats. Let's go get out of here. Time to face the reality of the desert. And there was hope. There was excitement. There was joy. We all love trips, right? We all love the adventure. Some of us don't love the delays in the airports or the trouble with the carburetor or whatever it might be. We're going to preach next week, Lord willing, on the message called Are We There Yet? And you can imagine where that one's going to go. But they needed to obey in the tough times. And we read in the last couple verses here before they begin their journey. Wherever the Lord set out, whenever the ark of the Lord set out, Moses said, Arise, O Lord, let your enemies be scattered, that those who hate you flee from before you. And when it rested, he said, Return, O Lord, to the countless thousands of Israel. He prayed, God, watch over, take care, guide them, look out for their enemies. J. Hudson Taylor was traveling to China, and he had hired a captain to take them through some difficult islands off the coast that we would think of the area of China, like Hong Kong area. Lots of little islands, lots of enemies, lots of pirates. There were cannibals that lived in that area. And the ship was stilled. There was no wind. And they put up the sails, they furled them all up because the ship was just there kind of drifting. And every day it drifted a little bit closer to an island. And on the shore they could see cannibals there preparing that proverbial big pot there to boil them in. And the ship's captain, not a believer, came to Hudson Taylor and said, Would you start praying that God would send some wind? Or we're going to all end up as guests for dinner that we don't want to be at. And Hudson Taylor looked at him and said, I'll start praying when you lower the sails and get ready for the wind. He had to show his faith before Hudson would pray. And by the way, they lowered the sails. J. Hudson Taylor prayed out loud on the deck. And before he got done with the prayer, the wind picked up, caught the sails, and moved the ship on away from danger. You see, we have on the board here two words or three words. Incomplete trust. What do we have? Do we have incomplete trust? Two words? Or do we have incomplete trust? Three words. God, go before us. Every day we need to pray that. Go before us. Take care of our enemies. It's too dangerous without you. And Lord, when it's time to camp, stay with us and watch over us here. A new ritual every day that would happen every time they moved, this prayer would be emphasized. We said that Moses said the prayer. We have rituals in our church on giving and singing and communion and baptism. And that it just reinforces the truth and reinforces our relationship. That we need to just trust the Lord. Okay, they're ready to go. Are we there yet? They're ready to walk out. head out 3 days. I wonder if they had complete trust or not. A little girl was lost in the woods, and a number of people were out searching for her. One rancher on horseback was out in a rough area, and he heard the voice of a little child. And he was so pleased. And then he stopped and listened to her. And she was doing A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R. And he thought, what in the world? Who's out here teaching a child schoolwork? And he went over to found her, and it was a little lost girl. And she said, I knew you'd find me. I knew it would be you that would come to find me. And he said, honey, he said, you don't even know me. And I heard you doing the alphabet. What was that? And she said, well, when I pray and I don't know exactly what to pray, I just pray all the letters and let God put the words together the way he wants to. I thought, that's what we need. The Lord knows the way through the wilderness. All we have to do is follow. And if we don't know, if we wonder, if we worry, let God put it all together.